our regular business. I'd like to turn to Judge Reyna for a motion.
Thank you, Judge Prosh. It's a real honor for me to move for admission of one of my law clerks. This is Christopher Christ. He is a member in good standing of the California State Bar, and he's been clerking with me for close to a year. It's going to be a year in a couple of weeks. And you know, they say, Chris, that time flies when you're working hard. Time must have really flown hard fast for you. And your hard work, your professionalism has brought credit not only to my chambers, to my work, but to the court as a whole. With that, I move for admission, though.
Okay.
You guys for admission to the fellowship.
I think we all agree that the best part about this wonderful job that each of us has are our colleagues on the court. So with enthusiasm, I grant the motion with Judge Lori's agreement. You may be sworn in.
You solemnly swear that you will comport yourself to determine the counsel of the court uprightly and according to law, and it will support the Constitution of the United States. I do. Congratulations. Welcome, fellowship.
Congratulations. Okay. First case for argument this morning is 14-1841, Personalized User Model versus Google. Mr. Pearlson, yes, when you're ready.
May it please the court. Your Honors, the district court erred in this case by taking the issue of discovery rule tolling away from the jury by replacing the jury's role as the fact finder and by misapplying binding Delaware law on discovery rule tolling.
Let me just start with just the background, just like where we are. This is your counterclaim to sue for breach of contract.
Sure,
so
yeah.
So that's the subject of the appeal here.
Exactly, Your Honor.
The infringement and the validity has all gone away.
Right, exactly. So at trial, we prevailed on infringement. There was a finding of no infringement. We prevailed on invalidity. There was a finding of invalidity. And we prevailed on the breach of contract claim, which occurred by virtue of the fact that the inventor, Mr. Koenig, was working at his prior employer, SRI, during the time he conceived the inventions of the patent suit. We discovered this during discovery in this case based on confidential documents, the deposition and interrogatory responses, and subsequently purchased the right from SRI, his prior employer, to assert this cause of action, breach of contract claim. It was tried before the jury, and we won on all counts, including discovery rule tolling. And then subsequent to trial, the judge indicated that he would likely grant Jamal in Pume's favor on discovery rule tolling, and eventually did just that. And we would submit, Your Honor, that there was no basis whatsoever to take this issue away from the jury.
But the question is whether the prior invention during employment was inherently unknowable. Now, a substantial, well-organized research institution, when a scientist is leaving, has on the last day or near that period, has an exit interview, and they want to find out whether the employee has fulfilled his contract and assigned all inventions that he's made to the company. Did that occur here?
Well, there's no evidence in the record as to whether an exit interview occurred or not.
Which means it probably didn't.
Well, maybe it did, maybe it didn't.
In which case, how could it have been inherently unknowable when they didn't perform these usual standard steps of when an employee is leaving?
Well, what the Delaware Supreme Court says in terms of when we determine whether blamelessly ignorant, which is, I think, along the lines of where you're going, is that they look to whether there was facts, the existence of facts that would have put an ordinary person on notice of an inquiry, which, if pursued, would have led to the discovery of the facts underlying the cause of action. And so what the Delaware Supreme Court says is, you know, we look to see what would have happened if you would have pursued. So let's say that there would have been an interview and they would have asked the questions. All the inferences at trial, or at least certainly viewed in our favor, would have suggested that that inquiry, if pursued, if, for example, that had happened, would have not accomplished anything in terms of discovering this.
Well, how can you say that? Wasn't there an employment contract between SRI and Dr. Koenig that specifically addressed inventions while Dr. Koenig was employed at SRI?
Certainly. And the reason why I say that, Your Honor, is precisely based on what Mr. Koenig said at trial. He testified at trial that he did not conceive of the invention while he was at SRI. And so the reasonable inference drawn from that would be that had SRI done an inquiry, asked him what he would have said, one of the things he may have done is lied and said, no, I didn't conceive it during this time. And in fact, the district court below acknowledged that.
You're arguing that there was no basis to make a reasonable inquiry.
Well, there's twofold. There's two aspects. Whether...
Shouldn't we start with the employment agreement as a basis?
Well, I don't know that an employment agreement in and of itself is a basis, and there certainly hasn't been any case law or authority cited that an employment agreement in and of itself is a basis to inquire whether someone's breached.
Maybe an employment agreement that specifically addresses intellectual property rights and the owner of any intellectual property rights that are developed during the term of the employment, and where you're employing a research scientist that you have employed in order to develop IP assets.
Well, Your Honor, that is a very commonplace agreement that in any technology company comes up. I don't think that essentially what would be the case if, in fact, the mere fact that you have an employment agreement would put you on inquiry notice to inquire whether there was a breach of that agreement would essentially mean that at any technology company, that anytime someone leaves, you have to ask the question, did you steal from us?
But there were subsequent events beyond the limitations period. There was a patent application filed and issued in this person's name, and one of the SRI employees tested this person's invention, and weren't those events that would should have put SRI on notice?
Well, Your Honor, with the reasonable inferences viewed in our favor, we would submit that no, that none of those things were the clear and unmistakable red flag that the Coleman Court, the Delaware Supreme Court, has found is required to put a company on notice. Let's first take the patent application. That was filed 5 months after he left SRI, after Mr. Koenig left SRI. The testimony elicited by Kuhn during trial was that we were in this internet gold rush in 1999. People were doing things fast. Well, viewing the facts in our favor, reasonably inferences in our favor, SRI could have viewed this 5 month period of time as more than enough time for him to come up with this invention on his own and would not have been a clear and unmistakable red flag. If it is, then we have the situation, and this is somewhat akin to what I had alluded to earlier, that you have a situation where anytime a former employee goes to another company and 5 months later down the road files a patent in the same general field, then there is this duty of that company to go and search and determine whether there was a breach. And especially
you're saying all these words. I don't think that anyone here suggests that was necessarily the burden. But here, nothing was done. There was no inquiry. And it seems your answer to that, your response to that is, well, if they had asked, he would have lied to them. So that whatever obligation they had to ask is irrelevant and shouldn't be held against them.
Well, right? Your Honor, I think that as a matter of law, as a matter of Delaware law, there is no requirement for a diligent inquiry. And in fact, that's what Coleman says, specifically says that.
Well, but Coleman doesn't undermine or undo. Coleman is consistent with the standards of blameless ignorance and inherently unknowable, right? Those standards still apply. Right?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And they do apply, and it's the application of those standards that Coleman shows that you don't actually have to have an inquiry even in itself if it would have been futile. And what Coleman looks at, it says...
How can you show? I mean, the burden is on you to show that it was would have been futile.
Right.
Right? And your answer, you, the way you've met the burden, you say, is to say, well, he would have lied to us anyway?
No. The burden that we said initially, what we've initially said, is that all the evidence that we relied on in trial and that we relied on to actually bring the counterclaim was confidential. None of it was available to SRI at the time, any time before trial. And so that was inherently unknowable. It was confidential. They hid it. They hid it. There was testimony at trial.
What evidence did you introduce that SRI was blamelessly ignorant?
Well, that is the notion of them being blamelessly ignorant is, in effect, the fact that they could not have discovered the breach because all the information was confidential. The information that we relied on at trial and to bring the claim was confidential documents.
What about the exit interview?
And well, I think the evidence would show that had they asked Mr. Koenig, that he would have said he did not conceive it at the time while he was at SRI.
But there were co-inventors of that patent, right? And people worked together, and they could have asked other employees.
Absolutely, they could have asked the co-inventors, and the result would have been the same. Berthold was one of the co-inventors.
You mean they all might have lied?
Well, Berthold wasn't involved in the conception at all. He was actually part of, I think his only contribution was in relation to a dependent claim that happened sometime after, you know, maybe in, he wasn't involved in this July timeframe while he was still at SRI, so he wasn't there. And then Tversky, he initially testified when I took his deposition, he initially testified that the date was in July of 1999 while Mr. Koenig was employed at SRI. But then once we brought the issue up and brought our counterclaim in relation to this, he changed his story. He changed his story, and he said that it was conceived after he left SRI. So there's every inference to suggest that had he done it. I'm sorry.
No, I just, before your time runs out, I wanted to direct you to your, I guess you have an alternative argument with respect to the tolling question, and that's the statutory one, so I thought you might want to spend a couple minutes
on
that.
Sure, I appreciate that, thank you. You know, this the tolling, this question is a very, you know, it's a simple question of law, really. The statute 8117 of Delaware says that, you know, if at the time the cause of action accrues against any person, it's basically told until that person comes back into Delaware.
Now, there's no case comparable to here with the circumstance similar to the circumstances in this case where that statutory provision has been applied.
Well,
right?
I would say that there's no case that's on all fours. There's probably only a few handful of cases that discuss it at all. But certainly, Saudi Basic is, if not on all fours, is similar in some respects.
Well, one striking difference, at least in my view, and you can tell me why I'm wrong about this, is between this and the Saudi cases. In the Saudi case, the parties were from Delaware. I mean, Delaware was the only place they could go. Whereas here, California is clearly a jurisdiction that where both the parties reside and where this case could have been pursued earlier.
Well, actually, in Saudi Basic, the plaintiff was a Saudi corporation. They were not a Delaware corporation. And it was a Saudi claim. It was a claim in relation to Saudi law.
So there was no other jurisdiction in the United States where this case could have been timely brought, right?
Well, I think it could have been brought in any jurisdiction. What happened was is that the plaintiff, the Saudi Basic plaintiff brought, and this is what the case is suggesting occurred, is that they were trying to avoid being sued in other jurisdictions, and then they brought a DJ action in Delaware because they thought that it had the most favorable statute of limitations. And so it could have been brought anywhere, but it was the choice of the plaintiff to bring it in, plaintiff Saudi Basic, to bring it in Delaware. Well, here, you know, there was no form shopping by Google. Google was in Delaware because that's where Pume filed its case. And in fact, as admitted by plaintiff in oral argument, it was actually the first time, oral argument on the JMAL below, is actually the first time that that the parties were in the same place where these rights of the breach of contract action could have been fixed.
But this provision, 8117, reads absence from state. Speaking of someone who was in state but is absent, whereas 8121 deals with out-of-state cause of action.
Well, the Delaware Supreme Court in Saudi Basic explicitly says, and this is, I think, at page 18 of the opinion, it says that it is settled law that the purpose and effect of Section 8117 is to toll the statute of limitations as to defendants who, at the time the cause of action accrues, are out of state and are not otherwise subject to service of process in the state. There's no suggestion that they have to leave. It just explicitly says that they're out, and that's
but
just what
happened. The title of the provision suggests it. Absence from state. You're not absent unless you're normally there.
Well, what the Delaware Supreme Court, what they have said is that...
And we're absent. Reviewing a decision of a Delaware judge, aren't we?
But it's a Delaware federal court judge who's not the Delaware Supreme Court. And also, Saudi Basic, the plaintiff in the Saudi Basic case was never in Delaware. It was never in Delaware. So they weren't, it's not like Saudi Basic was hanging out in Delaware and then left. They were never in Delaware. And so I think that conclusively shows that they don't have to have been there and then left.
Okay. You're well into your rebuttal time. We'll restore 4 minutes for rebuttal and let you on the other side.
Good morning, Your Honors. Just wanted to, Richard Targato for PUM. I just wanted to start out by speaking as to the first argument, as to the discovery rule. And it's really important to keep in mind here that Google has a burden to satisfy the test. And the test has been the same for quite a while now in Delaware, and remains the same today, which is a two-prong test, in which they have to show that it's inherently the injury.
Sure.
You understand that. And
all right. Well, let me ask you then. Just the one fact, clear fact, that all this stuff was confidential. I mean, they got this in this proceeding, but all of it was otherwise confidential. Why isn't that sufficient?
Well, one reason, going to the inherently undiscoverable prong alone, I think it still would not be sufficient simply because all it asks is you have sufficient facts that you can then follow up on and dig deeper. I would think that this was found out during discovery. That same discovery could have happened had SRI been vigilant, had they followed up on the objective factors they could have seen and pursued that.
Wait, how so? Well, they have an exit interview. The guy says, no, I didn't, I'm doing this because I loved it. No suggestion that there was any wrongdoing that's apparent in anything he says. And then they presumably might well have satisfied this requirement, right? Don't you get the impression reading the district court that if they had had an exit interview, even if the guy had lied or whatever, that he wasn't necessarily requiring that they go further than that in that instance, right?
Absolutely, Your Honor, absolutely. I think that this is not about did SRI do enough. The fact is SRI did nothing, and that there's no evidence of SRI doing anything. Going back
to... Can't we clearly infer that if they had done all... So we're saying they just had the duty to inquire, like saying, well, where are you going and find out a little about what he was working on? Well, can't we clearly infer that they would not have discovered this based on that inquiry? So why shouldn't that end the case and be sufficient in terms of their burden?
Well, Your Honor, going back to what Judge Stark found, I think he directly addressed that. And she found that three things could have happened. If they had actually sat down, Dr. Koenig, and asked him that question, do you have some IP you're taking with you? What are you doing here? Where are you going? Three things would have happened. One, he would have said, sure, I have this IP that I'm taking with me. Well, obviously, that would have led one direction. He could have lied, which is what Mr. Perlson has suggested would have happened. That would be a fundamentally different analysis. That would be essentially a fraudulent concealment situation. That would be a totally different analysis. I don't think at that point we could really say that if SRI had asked Dr. Koenig...
What if the third option, if he had kind of sidestepped the question? So he changed the subject, he just started talking about family, and then it went on. Would that have satisfied their obligation then, even if he sidestepped the question and they didn't really press it or force an answer?
Well, at that point, Your Honor, I would suggest that if you're a company and you think you have a right to IP and you ask somebody that question and they stonewall on you, there is, at that point, that's an objective factor. You need to dig deeper, and that's exactly where that should have gone.
Well, they have a the provision we're talking about, I think Judge Reina talked about, it's in the contract.
Yes.
There's an obligation. So why are we involved in an exit interview? This guy had an obligation to come forward. Why couldn't SRI have said, well, we know he's not taking IP with us because we have a right to presume that he's going to follow his legal obligation under the contract, and therefore he would tell us if he didn't. So why isn't that enough to get you by this sort of level of requirement of an inquiry?
Well, I would submit that's because this is, again, an equitable doctrine. This tolling provision is an equitable doctrine, and under Delaware law, equity aids only the vigilant. And there is some minimum threshold that to enforce that, they have to do something. I think if they're simply bringing a cause of action later, I don't think there's a legal claim that you can come back and say, well, you didn't ask me when I left. I think that's different. But when they're actually trying to toll a statute of limitations, that is an equitable doctrine and does have this blameless ignorance standard. That is one of the two components.
Was there any evidence presented that would have showed that had SRI followed up or made some further inquiry, that they still would not have discovered the work that Dr. Koenig did while employed?
I would submit no, Your Honor, simply because had they followed up, that there were various things they could.
Was there any evidence presented to that effect?
No, Your Honor, not that I'm recalling.
Okay, under the statute, are they required to present this type of evidence?
Was PUM required to present evidence?
Yes.
No, Your Honor. The burden entirely rests on Google on that point. And it was Google's burden to prove, one, that it was inherently undiscoverable, and two, the blameless ignorance standard.
And you're saying that Google did not present any evidence that would go to prove that particular point?
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct. Instead, what Google's argument was that this was confidential information, that certain documents were kept confidential. But I think it's also important to note, and this wasn't really put before the court, but it's in the briefing, it's mentioned, is that another argument Google dealt with was the argument of whether this IP was related and resulted from the work that Dr. Koenig was doing while he was at SRI. Now, that's an important fact because, again, we lost on that. That's when the jury found, indeed, the IP at issue was related to and resulted from the work Dr. Koenig was doing. And that's, again, not an appeal. It's not been challenged. So accepting that predicate fact right there, we have SRI looking at IP that they should have been able to recognize pretty easily as, well, gosh, this is exactly what Dr. Koenig was doing for us for the last several years. I think that right there is an objective factor that should have put them on notice that, indeed, let's dig a little bit deeper here.
Well, but that came up later, right? They didn't know that at the time of his
that it was, well, whether it terminated. Resulted from, or if they had looked, they would have found out. I mean, they looked at the patent. The patent is noticed to the whole world, obviously. And once the patent was issued at that time, even a minimal exercise of diligence, so they can see what if our former employees patented. Since we think we have a right to their IP, let's take a look at what they patented. Well, they look at the patent, they see this is what he was working on. Apparently,
what about the alternative ground for affirming the jury? The statute is clear, right? There's no dispute that the statutory language is unambiguous.
That's
so you and Judge Stark agreed, undermine the clear statutory language, but the argument is that this wasn't the purpose. Isn't that a tough road in terms of how we're supposed to construe a statute? I mean, okay, if it's ambiguous, then you start, if there's some ambiguity, you start looking as purpose, yada-da. But when the language of the statute is clear, frankly, even if the legislature didn't really intend it would be applied as expansively as it was, isn't that up to them to change and not us to change?
Well, there certainly is the absurd results doctrine. But long before you get to the absurd results concept, I would submit this isn't one statute. This is two separate statutes. And the courts in Delaware have already said these statutes are not meant to be read together. There's actually a case here I have that's in the brief, Glassberg, which came out, this is 1955, right after these statutes were actually enacted. And it says, according to this court, to read the tolling statute, which is 8117, into the borrowing statute, would stultify the effects of the borrowing statute. An out-of-state exception for foreign cause of action will not be read into the Delaware statute of limitations. essentially you have two statutes here. Delaware has one statute, which is meant to protect, for example, if there's an event or a cause of action that arises in Delaware, and then that would-be defendant leaves the state. You can't get them. They're hiding out of state somewhere. Well, this statute protects the Delaware plaintiff to be able to say, you know what, when you came back to the state, I have you now. It may have been 15 years, but you've come back in. 8121, the borrowing statute, conversely, has the opposite effect. It is meant to prevent forum shopping by shortening the statute of limitations. Well, what Google has done here is they first took the borrowing statute, which we went with Delaware law here because Delaware has a 3-year statute of limitations, whereas California, where this cause of action arose, would be a 4 or 5 year statute of limitations. And so what they did was they took that 4 or 5 year, they took it 3 years. They said, well, Delaware is shorter, so we take Delaware law. Now, that's serving 8121 perfectly. But then it's sort of a Trojan horse situation, where once you have 8121 applied in that 3-year statute, they then bring in 8117 and say, but wait, now that we have Delaware law, let's back it way back out, and now we have no statute of limitations effectively.
Right, but where's the lack of, but there's, what I'm searching for is a lack of clarity, and you're right, and we can call it a Trojan horse, but the fact is it exists. So why is it not up to the legislature in a case where the language is clear, there's no argument of ambiguity, why isn't it up to them to say, oops, we goofed, versus us to tell them they didn't really mean what they said?
Well, the way the Delaware courts resolve that is to say which statute came first. They enacted, and I want to make sure I'm looking.
Well, you say the Delaware court. The Supreme Court has kind of adopted this, right, in the Saudi case. So the Supreme Court's only spoke, because the only time they've spoken on this, they've applied the statute as written. Right.
Well, actually, in Saudi Basic, they didn't actually apply it technically. What they did was they said the borrowing statute in the first place, the 8121 statute, didn't apply. And so that was the actual holding of Saudi Basic, was the analysis stops right here, 8121 doesn't apply, there's no borrowing statute, game over. Then they went on to say, essentially, what is dicta, even if 8121 were to apply, it still wouldn't work under 8117. And we still, and that's essentially where that went. So it wasn't directly applying, saying that 8117 can be applied with 8121. The only time that issue has been looked at, the court came out the opposite direction, saying the borrowing statute was enacted after 8117. So the out-of-state party tolling statute was adopted first, then the borrowing statute was adopted. And when courts have looked at that, they've said, well, when a legislature goes ahead and they enact a later statute, their failure to acknowledge, they knew 8117 was on the books. They made no mention of it. They made no reference to it. Implicitly, they therefore, the legislature meant for that not to apply. So arguably, the legislature already spoke to this when they did not incorporate 8117 into 8121. And so by virtue of that, the two statutes simply are not meant to be put together.
Okay. It's up to you, but you reserve some time for rebuttal on the cross-appeal, which means you've got to get to the cross-appeal now.
Sure. Yeah. The cross-appeal is pretty simple. On this one, it's, again, it's a document. The term document, plan construction issue. And that's something where obviously we lost.
But you filed no JMAL on the PTAC case. I don't know, but I assume that plan construction might have been a piece of that, and you dismissed the appeal and didn't appeal.
Correct. The patents
game over, right?
The patents are dead.
Where's the controversy?
Well, the controversy there, and that's again, really, I turn here to the Supreme Court language I wanted to read, which is from Camretta v. Green. A party who seeks review of the merits of an adverse ruling, but is frustrated by the vagaries of circumstance, ought not, in fairness, be forced to acquiesce in that ruling. The situation we have here is a bad.
Well, it's frustrated by the vagaries of that ruling. Really? I mean, how do we apply that here? How do we know that was...
We vacate the claim construction. I mean, that's essentially what we're asking for here, is a situation where we have a bad claim construction that we can't appeal. We really can't. I mean,
if you can't appeal... Case over, right?
Well, there's other patents, though, that have that exact same claim term in this family of patents.
Okay.
Those patents aren't invalid. And now, is there a lot of controversy as to them? There's not. But where arguments are only concern here, it's a very small, narrow concern here.
Well, whether you have a concern or not doesn't mean, as Judge Rayner pointed out, there's some controversy. There's a live controversy here.
I mean,
I have a concern about a lot of things, but that doesn't mean that I can go into court and get an Article III court to decide it.
That's correct. And so to that end, we're not asking the court to construe document. We're asking the court simply to vacate the construction because, again, it doesn't affect the outcome here. The patents are dead here.
Well, I mean, that's not an answer. I mean, whether or not there's a for us to do anything. It's not a question of like, okay, so it's a little shaky whether you can hear this case, so all we're asking you to do is vacate rather than reverse.
Sure.
Really? I mean, that's not...
It's fair. I mean...
What's fair?
Well, your question there, that's a very...
How can we even do that if we don't have jurisdiction over your cross?
And that, again, is exactly... If that's the outcome, that's fine as well.
I mean, you didn't preserve the issue, right? You didn't move for a JMAL on this particular issue.
No, because so
there's no lot of controversy.
It would have wasted the court's time to do that here. That's exactly...
Well, it's kind of wasting our time, too, because...
Yeah, no,
you bring up an issue and there's no controversy on
it. Exactly.
Okay.
And we're doing it out of abundance and making sure we're not bound by that 2 years down the road.
Wait, so you think whatever collateral estoppel thing or whatever might conceivably come down the road, the fact that you raised this as a cross appeal and took our time and effort in dealing with this issue, just the fact that you raised it, so you did it just for a process kind of
reason? No, there have been various factors in this, Your Honor. We genuinely feel the claim construction is wrong. We wanted to raise it. We feel like there are reasons here, arguably, that it could be a lot of controversy, but I probably side with you that it's not. So I ultimately agree with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to just address a few points. First of all, on 8117, there was some discussion about the borrowing statute and the interplay with 8117. In Saudi Basic, there was two questions at issue. One related to the borrowing statute, and then the other related to 8117. And it was not dicta, as counsel represents, that happened in Saudi Basic in relation to 8117. There were two reasons, and it explicitly says, and this is on page 18 of the Saudi Basic decision, the conclusion that ExxonMobil's counterclaims were not time-barred was correct for a second independent reason. Even if the borrowing statute did apply and thereby triggered Delaware's 3-year statute of limitations, Delaware's tolling statute stopped the running of the statute of limitations until Saudi Basic filed this action and as a result became amenable to service of process. It was a second independent reason. The Glassberg case was a court of chancery opinion from like 1955, and to the extent that it held that the borrowing statute and 8117 couldn't be used in the same case, it's clearly overturned by Saudi Basic because it did that. And we are not relying on the borrowing statute for 8117 to apply. 8117 applies regardless of the borrowing statute. In fact, it's actually Hume that's relied on the borrowing statute by having the 3-year rather than the 4-year limitation from California apply. And from the beginning, it was actually the plaintiff, Pume, that said Delaware law should apply. We said, okay, we didn't dispute that. And they chose Delaware law. And then now they're sort of trying to suggest that somehow we're being sneaky by using the very law that they applied. So they are not inconsistent with each other, and they should be applied just as what was said in Saudi Basic. In terms of the point about what could have been discovered through discovery and then also, you know, whether there was evidence presented that a investigation wouldn't have uncovered anything.
Do you agree that it was your obligation to present that type of evidence?
Yeah, it was our burden, and we did that, and we did that, I think, in several ways.
What did you do?
Well, we presented evidence that all the evidence that that we relied on at trial and to bring the claim was confidential and unknown to SRI. That was in evidence that was presented to the jury. And it was unrebutted. And then we also presented evidence of the evidence, frankly, elicited by PUM as to what that Koenig said that he didn't conceive it during his time frame while he was at SRI, thus leading to the inference that had SRI asked that same question, they would have gotten the same answer. And this notion that we discover these things during discovery and that SRI should have done some further investigation to uncover that, there is no evidence whatsoever that any further investigation would have done anything. And that, frankly, Your Honor, is one of the problems with the lower court's opinion, in that it engages in this speculation as to what SRI would have done if SRI would have asked the question at the Texas interview.
To me, that brings us back to the beginning of the argument when Judge Lori asked about the exit interview. Isn't it commonplace for there to be an exit interview?
It may or may not be. There certainly was no evidence to that. But one thing that I think is clear in Delaware law, and I just want to point to that before we out, is that in the Lawton case, which is the seminal case in 1968 in Delaware, there was no inquiry. In the Morton v. Skynails case,
and Lawton is the one where the woman had something.
Yeah, it's not directly on point.
I mean,
But the point, I think the point is that the plaintiff in this case was blamelessly ignorant of the act or omission injury complained of. She had no way of knowing that her rights had been violated until the first pain was experienced. And that's the point that we're making here, is that even had SRI asked questions, had they done the exit interview, that the inferences drawn in our favor, now, we submit show that they wouldn't
case.
Have discovered
that
anything.
That may be the case, but they didn't even take that initial step.
Right.
I mean, that's missing. I mean, to ask the very basic question, what is it that you've been working on while you've been here? What are you taking with you? What do you have in that bag?
Understood. I think that the Delaware law, what it says is that to be blamelessly ignorant is not whether you asked a question necessarily, but whether an inquiry, if pursued, if you did it, would have uncovered anything. And so the person who investigates for a month and finds nothing is just as blamelessly ignorant as the person who doesn't ask and wouldn't have uncovered anything. And it basically, Delaware law logically, does not penalize a party for not conducting an inquiry that would have been futile.
Okay, thank you for your argument. And I know you reserved rebuttal, but you didn't respond to your cross appeal. That's why we thank both counsel. The case is submitted.